Well, it is 4:03. I have. So we'll just get this meeting started. I'll start with roll call. Anderson,
Here.
Bork,
Here.
Gade is here. Grim, Harrelson, Krylov, Murray,
Here.
Shetty,
Here.
Silman,
Here.
Smith,
Here.
and then Treyer is also absent today. Okay, so next is approval of the minutes of the November 10th meeting. Is there any edits or anything needed for the minutes?
Shetty moves to approve.
Okay, great.
Smith can second.
All right, all in favor?
Aye.
All right, motion passes. First agenda item is announcements and reports and action items from the last meeting.
All right, so hopefully, as noted, each of you were thinking about potential nominations or self-nominations for chair and vice chair, which you'll see we'll get to under new business today. And then a request was made for a HERS program report, aiming roughly for the February meeting. I touched in with Danny Bissell and have begun working on combing through that data with him. So we anticipate being able to deliver that report then for you. We have no upcoming events in the 3 weeks between now and Christmas. But if anybody has any events they'd like to mention out in the community. No, busy holidays for us all. The next item on the list then is the New York Times article. Some of you may have seen this, that our Fair Free Service was recognized, which was very exciting. I've been telling folks my favorite part of it was that our downtown ambassadors got up early to make sure the streets were extra clean ahead of the reporter arriving, which I just warms my heart every time I think about it. There was a correction that was printed to the emissions numbers that were initially reported in that, and I did want to take just a few moments to discuss that with you as a commission, as to what the background was on that, and so in case you get any questions about it out in the community. Basically, when the Fare Free program was launched, our transit staff were looking for a ridership number that they could attach to the city's greenhouse gas emissions reductions goals. And because there was no existing data for us to draw on as to what the impacts might be in increasing ridership, and there wasn't really an established methodology. There were a couple different methods explored for how they might tie ridership to greenhouse gas reductions, and they settled on one that seemed like it might be a workable estimate. It was not the intention at the time. When our staff, Danny, was helping formulate a couple different approaches that number would be used to create then a greenhouse gas reduction number based on ridership, but that's how it ended up getting used. And we have since reached out to them to talk about how we might use VMT as a better measure. Our greenhouse gas inventory for the city is based on VMT reductions as the point for calculating, and that's pretty standard. We just didn't really have access to those numbers until very recently because they come out once a year in June and they cover the previous year. So if you think about it, there's almost an 18-month lag between when we would have launched Fare Free and when we would have started getting that VMT data. Now that we have it, we will be using that to go forward. And when the New York Times wrote and said, "Hey, we've got some readers who are questioning some of these GHG reduction numbers," the first thing we did was take the method from our greenhouse gas inventory based on VMT and recalculate it. I do want to emphasize both of these numbers are estimates, right? But in the end, we thought the VMT number was the better number to offer up as a correction because it's consistent with our greenhouse gas practices. And we have a large data set going back now, and we'll have that data going forward to give us a basis of comparison. So People are often surprised when we talk about our greenhouse gas inventory to learn we don't have sensors on everything that enable us to keep very precise numbers. And if at any time you have any questions about how we calculate greenhouse gas emissions, I'm happy to talk about the different estimates that are used and what we think are the pros and cons of each. But basically, that's how we started with a big number and arrived at a lower number. And I will say, part of what I have found myself thinking about a lot after this is, one, something Wendell Berry says about how, who's an environmental writer, about how we all want solutions that are as big as the problem. And I think that's true as much for our staff as anyone else. Like, we all want to pull a really big lever that's going to course correct. But the truth is, you know, greenhouse gases are driven by all human activity. And so that means working on all human activity to address them, right? And on the one hand, it's a bummer because like 24,000 tons is like such a great number and fun to report on. But on the other hand, I'm always reminded when you report on smaller numbers, it does make meaningful action feel a little more in reach. And so that's the upside of it, right? It's a smaller number, but it's one that feels a little easier to get to. Hopefully we'll get to it year after year. So I just wanted to share that. If there are any questions, I'll pause here and answer them.
Just wanted to clarify that number, yeah. The 778, that was for 1 year?
That was for 1 year. And that was based on the vehicle miles traveled reduction, which I will also say the other thing I have thought about, and we've been talking about this even before the article came out. Actually, we've been talking with all of you over the last several years, is how do we report on our activities that is not just based on emissions, right? Because nobody really knows what a ton of greenhouse gas emissions looks like. Like, how many tons are in this room right now? I couldn't say. I suspect no one else could, right? But we all have an intuitive sense of what a mile is. And we also know vehicle miles traveled and reduced vehicle miles traveled tells us not only what we're accomplishing, but also what we need to do more of. And so I think it's a more intuitive and human-scaled measure. And the more we can find measures like that to track our efforts, I think the better it's going to be for us and the community. It just is just easier to visualize. All right. Oh, and then the saddest part of the agenda, recognizing our outgoing members. We have such a good group of commissioners every year. I always get so sad when we realize we are saying goodbye to several. But why don't we... I have things that I'd like to say, but I think traditionally we start with the chair, so.
Oh, my goodness. Well, thank you. I mean, yeah, it's hard to believe that this is the last meeting, I feel like, which just started not too long ago. But it's just been great to work with everybody and meet new people, too, on the commission. So, yeah, I'm excited to stay in touch with everything that you're doing. And I think you'll be in good hands. There's another public health staff member that'll be joining, too. So, yeah, I'm planning on having another baby in May. And so I was like, it's a good time to step down, too. So I'm excited to see what happens with the commission. So good luck to everybody.
Thank you for your service.
Angie or Michelle, would either of you like to say anything?
Sure. It's been fun being part of this and getting to know everybody and also getting to learn a lot about what's happening behind the scenes of the city. So I feel, I guess, you know, more incorporated into the community now since being part of this commission. And I'm really glad that I had the opportunity to do it. So I want to thank all of you for, you know, being part of that for me. And also, you know, I will definitely be, you know, keeping my eye out for what's happening in the future with the city and the Climate Action Commission. So thank you.
Yes, it's been the opportunity that serving on the commission has offered me has been really great. Earlier this year, I got to interview Veronica O'Davis. That was a really cool opportunity that was made available because I serve on this commission and serving on the steering committee for the comprehensive plan. I think, too, just like Michelle said, just being aware and more engaged about all the happenings going on the city and having a part of that, there's a great sense of pride, I think, in all of the city's endeavors, and being part of that's been really exciting. And I just wanted to be thankful for the opportunity. It's been great.
Well, I'll say on behalf of staff, we're also thankful for the time and energy and thought you all have invested in the commission. Each person comes to this commission with unique gifts, and I know it's not going to surprise anybody to hear, you know, when I say Angie's such a great transportation advocate, and Michelle has really helped us with some of our thinking about climate communications, and Jamie's brought such an invaluable public health perspective, that we're just grateful for the time we've had together and that you've given so generously in what is essentially a volunteer position for 3 years running. So, I think I myself am in a little denial that come January, you aren't all going to be sitting here with us, but I hope you will feel free to stay in touch and to attend meetings as your schedules allow. We would certainly love to have any of you back with us.
We could spice it up with the public comment. An opportunity.
Ask really hard questions.
Yeah. Just wait.
I have a little gift for you before you leave, so please don't run out of the room at the end of the meeting.
Cool. Well, thank you. Well, we'll move on to the new business. Sounds like a confirmed meeting location and times for next year.
Yeah, so we have the city manager's conference room that we looked at previously reserved for all of next year. I did want to ask a question about whether there would be any appetite or interest in having a couple meetings outside of City Hall in the year ahead. And this may be a question we can raise when our new members get here as well. But it's occurred to me, for example, the airport commission regularly meets in a meeting room at the airport. And if we did so, and we posted about it in advance to, you know, be in compliance with public meetings laws, that might give us the opportunity to take a look at the solar array out there and do some thinking about the airport. Similarly, our water treatment plant has a conference room. I could look into using that, or the Eastside Recycling Center. It might just be an opportunity to see other locations in the city and what's going on there. So, I see a lot of heads nodding, so I feel like among the existing members, maybe there's some interest in doing that next year. Okay. Why don't we touch back in when we get our new members in here, too, and we'll pick a couple dates that might be workable and some locations you'd be interested in seeing and see what we can do about having a meeting out there. Look at this. We get out of council chambers and just everything cuts loose.
All right. Well, exciting. Next order of business would be the election of next year's chair and vice chair. So should we just start with nomination? I guess we could do this either way. Nominations. Maybe let's start with chair and then do nominations. And then, I don't know, what do we want to do? Acceptance and then vote and then do nominations.
Yeah, usually what we do is nominations or self-nominations for chair, and then the people nominated accept or decline, and then there is a vote.
Okay, perfect. Well, starting with chair, any nominations for 2026 chair of the Climate Action Commission?
This is Shetty. I'd like to nominate Zach for chair.
See a thumbs up, yeah. Okay.
Thank you.
Zach, would you like to accept this nomination?
Yeah, sure. I would.
Okay.
Yes.
Wonderful.
I am interested. I don't know if I'm supposed to talk.
You can.
Okay. Yeah. No, I am interested in doing it. I really enjoy the work of the commission. I think it's really important. And for me, I don't know, each kind of step that I take getting more involved in city operations, I just find it more and more interesting. So I would really enjoy taking that next step as well. So, yeah, thanks.
Are there any other nominations?
I I think we need a second for the nomination then.
This is Murray, I second.
Perfect. All right, well, let's take a vote then. All those in favor of Zach being the chair?
Aye.
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 Aye. Aye.
Okay. None opposed. Wonderful. Okay. Motion passes. Congratulations.
Well, thanks, everybody.
You'll be a great chair. Okay, let's move on to vice chair then. Any nominations for a vice chair?
Trying to make eye contact.
I know, like, who wants it? You can also self-nominate as well.
This is Shetty again. I'll nominate Michael.
This is Murray. I would second that nomination.
Uh-huh. Michael, do you accept the nomination?
I do. I accept the nomination. I don't really have a speech prepared.
We take it back. No, I'm just kidding.
But no, I would. Yeah, I think that would be great. I'm learning more and more. I feel more prepared than I have in the past, certainly to take a next step on the commission. So, yeah, I think similarly, it's important work, and I'd be happy to do that.
Great. Well, seeing no other nominations, we will move to a vote. All those in favor?
Aye.
Okay. Any opposed? No. Okay. Wonderful. Motion passes. Congratulations.
That is the smoothest this process has ever gone. Thank you all.
Wonderful.
I object. It's rarely contentious. It hasn't been since I've been here. Anyway.
Yeah, we suffer more from humility than ambition.
All right, wonderful. You'll both be excellent. Super excited for both of you. All right, so we're moving on to old business, the prioritization scoring of accelerating Iowa City's climate action plan.
So as you recall, we had adaptation measures last time to take a look at, and we added sustainability to this month's packet as well. They're both pretty short sections, so I'm really hopeful we'll get through them in short order. Why don't we run through and do a recap? We'll start with adaptation, and then we'll pause and score, and if time allows, then we'll run through sustainable lifestyle as well. Okay. All right, so the first item under adaptation is to develop a climate ambassador team. That, of course, has been an ongoing process for us. We do have 10 different cohorts have gone through, and we did pause the program a little last year to take a look back at what was working and not working. Now that we have Kendall with us, we're hoping to relaunch in the coming year. And we're actually hoping to relaunch on both fronts. Over time, we've developed both a community ambassador program and a staff ambassador program, and both have proven valuable. So we're hoping to do both in the coming year. One thing that we're exploring is bringing together some alumni from previous cohorts to talk about what they would like to see in the program going forward. And in particular, we've had an idea. The long-term goal has always been to try to pair the Climate Ambassador Program with our engagement efforts with community organizations. We had this idea early on that maybe a community organization will put its hand up and say, we'd like our staff to be trained as climate ambassadors, or, you know, folks we work with. And that's never really quite materialized. Recently, we had come across a model where a community organization is paired with a climate ambassador cohort, where once they complete the training, and Zach, you've been through it, so you could speak to this. We've asked that, as kind of to graduate, people conduct climate conversations with community members to just help plug people more into the city's efforts. The idea this time would be to take the cohort and give them the training and support needed to work with the organization that's being paired with the cohort to develop their own climate action plan. So I'll use as an example, because we've been having these conversations recently, The United Way, let's say they're the organization that we would work with, our climate ambassadors would lead the conversations to help them identify what their climate priorities are and what resources are available to them. And staff would be present for these discussions, but we wouldn't take the lead on having them. And then at the end, similar to what we've been doing with the Resilience Hubs, we would pair a little implementation grant with it for the participating organizations so that they could immediately get to work on some of the goals they identify through the process. So I'm very interested in this. I think Kendall seems very excited about the idea. I think it might be a nice way to grow now that we're in our, it's not quite right to call it the second decade of climate ambassadors, but the next 10 cohorts, you know, what we could be doing. So that's just a little where we're at with the program. The next item is establish resilience hubs. As you know, we've got two resilience hubs going now. You just heard the report from the bike library. I'm hoping in the coming months you're going to be getting a similar report from NCJC, which is using their implementation grant to add a backup energy generator to the new location they're building. And I think once they do that, the idea is they'll add generators to the other two existing locations as well. We feel like that's been a very successful program. I don't know that we have the funding to pursue a third site for the next year or two. So what we'll probably do is continue to engage with the existing hubs, though we have been speaking with another organization that is interested in participating in the program in the future. And we think what we might do while funds are a little tight is try to work with them to develop some, identify some grant opportunities that might help fund their activities. So that's a little where that program is at the moment. And I know I'm moving through these quickly, but if anybody has anything to add or would like to share, please do. The next item is educate and coordinate with local agencies on health impacts. Here especially, I think we've really benefited from having Jamie on the commission in creating some really robust communication channels with Johnson County Public Health. And one of the biggest ways we've been collaborating actually is on the Resilience Hub efforts. Jamie's colleague, Nate Savage, has been working with us in connecting those organizations with emergency management resources in the county, and in fact did a follow-on grant to the Heat Island grant that we had had to do high heat planning with NCJC, which was a really interesting exercise to go through. It was basically like an emergency preparedness exercise to think about how they might adapt events they're holding or their operations based on high heat warnings, knowing that a lot of their kids, you know, play outside during the day and a lot of their programming happens in the outdoors. It's actually, I think we've, I don't know, would you say it's fair? I feel like we've got a pretty robust working relationship with public health now.
Yeah, I would say so.
Yeah, and I think they've been providing really great support. I'd actually reached out to Jamie while I was at the conference in California to be like, hey, what kind of data can we get on emergency room visits during high heat events? And Jamie's amazing and had it before, like information before I even returned from California, I think. So I anticipate a lot of our ongoing engagement on the public health front is going to continue to look at the high heat impacts, partly because that is a climate vulnerability that's not been very well explored in the past. I mean, we have a pretty solid sense of flooding impacts in the community, but not high heat. And even now, we have a pretty good understanding, I think, of what the risks are for outdoor exposure, but indoor exposure remains a real unknown, and we anticipate continuing to work with public health to think through what we could be doing in terms of climate preparedness. The next item is concentrated education campaign for private properties about native plantings, permeable pavement, rain gardens, soil health, rain barrels, and cisterns. We've had a number of efforts on these, this front. I think some big highlights you probably remember is the Your Best Lawn video campaign that our Neighborhood Development Services has been running for the last several years, which focuses on alternatives to turf grass lawns. And it's really a great series because it focuses on alternative lawns within Iowa City, so things that are actually being implemented here. We also coordinate regularly with our stormwater engineer on, oh, I can never remember what SQR stands for, but basic, oh, yes, soil quality restoration, which is a 50-50 matching grant for Iowa City residents who want to do things like add organic material to their lawns. That's the most common use for it. Some people sometimes use it to add permeable pavers to their driveways. We don't actually administer those programs ourselves, but we do promote them. And we're in regular conversation with the stormwater manager who does. I would say in terms of things that our office does directly, our biggest win of late has been, you might recall last year we gave a climate action grant to Burr Oak to do a targeted campaign in the East Side neighborhood on native plantings and shrubs. That actually was so successful that we just went back to them at the end of the program and said, hey, rather than apply for a grant again, why don't we just make this a standing relationship? So we've provided funding for them to purchase additional shrubs, and they have agreed to continue to do the outreach and help with that. And the thing I really love is I see it as a nice parallel to our Root for Trees program, because we're building both the overstory and the understory, which is great. I think we'll see how that program goes this year, but I could easily see that being one we continue going forward. AE5, coordinated efforts with local emergency agencies and utility agencies providing critical infrastructure. Most of our efforts in this area have been participating in the COAD process, which is a process administered by, it's actually convened by the United Way here, but it's done in collaboration with emergency management. And it's just a coordinating activity between different organizations. They had invited us to the table based on our work with resilience hubs, which is something they're interested in both tapping into and maybe even expanding throughout the county. In surrounding communities. So most of the work we do there is just, and I think you're going to find this with the sections, both in adaptation and sustainable lifestyle, there's a lot of overlap between these different sections. Most of that work with emergency management coordination really has flowed from the work with resilience hubs. Yeah. The next item, partnering with Project Green on tree planting partnership, for incentives for private tree planting, this is one that I actually would recommend changing the wording to partner with local agencies on tree planting partnerships, in part because we have approached Project Green several times over the years, and sort of a classic case of saying, hey, this agency is doing this, they'd be great to partner with, and then when you go and talk to them, they're like, we're at capacity and don't really feel like taking this on. But there have been other organizations, you know, over time, Burr Oak being a great example, that have come forward and been interested in partnering. So I think just broadening the language on this one would be helpful. Otherwise, the tree planting partnerships we really do, or the efforts have really focused heavily on the incentives for private tree planting, and that's really taken the form of Root for Trees, which, as you know, is very successful. We're having solid applications even this year, which I think is our sixth year for Root for Trees, fifth or sixth year, and we still get a good number of applications coming in for it.
Sarah, would there, excuse me, yeah. Would there be an opportunity to, I don't know, I'm just spitballing here, but expand that to beyond trees to natives with like, I don't know, backyard abundance or one of those sort of prairie-focused organizations as well, where I know there's a lot of places where on city property we have planted prairie, and that seems to be going very well. Are there places where we should be looking at that? You know, we've got incentives for trees, we've got education about native plantings, but... Mm-hmm. I don't know. Would that be one opportunity to expand? I'm just looking for opportunities to, like, all of these things seem like they're going really well, and I'm not really sure
how we grow any of them.
Right. Or where it even makes sense to dial back because everything is just like going smoothly. So,
yeah, I don't want to influence your votes by saying I can kind of imagine how many of these would be scored, but I can kind of imagine it based on, you know, things do seem to be running well, and we do seem to, at some of them, have kind of reached the limits of what we can do. This one, I do think this is a good question, that there are opportunities for other partnerships. I don't know if it's with Backyard Abundance specifically,
yes,
but we could certainly reach out to them. And in fact, actually I've recently had a conversation with Fred about, you know, whether it would be good to revisit some of these questions. There is, I think, an interesting opportunity related to Prairie specifically with Johnson County, which had launched a pocket Prairie program earlier this year for residents in the unincorporated parts of the county. We had reached out to Casey Hutchinson, who actually used to be on the Climate Action Commission, to see if there might not be opportunities to partner there as well, recognizing, of course, you know, they're administering the program and, you know, they have capacity. We have to be mindful of their capacity too. But Casey actually was very enthusiastic and said that they had already been thinking about maybe making inroads in Iowa City. And the county said that they were comfortable continuing to administer the program if we just wanted to help get the word out. So I think that's one way we can further native efforts and prairie efforts within city limits. And that's helpful too, because frankly, Casey's an expert in that area and no one on our climate staff is. So that's a good partnership for us. Mm-hmm. Thanks for the thoughtful question. All right. The street tree ordinance, this one's sort of been in a holding pattern. Neighborhood Development Services began drafting an ordinance. I think it kind of got put on the back burner once we knew we were going to have a comp plan update, because normally your zoning flows from your comprehensive plan. So I think that is one that could be revisited after the new comprehensive plan is adopted, but I don't know. That's one I can check in on and with NDS on. NDS being Neighborhood Development Services.
Sarah, really quick, what would the street tree ordinance be exactly?
They take a lot of forms. The street tree ordinance, this is a really good question. It could be a requirement about how street trees are maintained. It could be an ordinance requiring a new development, a certain provision for street trees. Right now in our current ordinances, I think we require for every new house that's developed that a tree be planted on the property. I actually, admittedly, am a little fuzzy on what a street tree, what that element about it would be specifically. It could be a requirement simply that the right-of-ways are developed wide enough to allow for street trees. I think that's where, you know, it flowing from the comprehensive plan becomes a little more clear. I will say I was recently heartbroken to find out I can't get a street tree in front of my house because my right-of-way is not wide enough. So that's very top of mind as an example for me.
Sarah, this is Silman. So what happens when people don't plant trees in their new developments, and if it's supposed to happen, like how does that get evaluated?
Well, there is an inspection process when a new house goes up, and they would identify whether or not a tree has been planted, presumably. As to what follows from that, I don't know. It could be, I mean, in most cases, when you have an inspection, you have to come up to compliance before you can put it on the market or you can offer it up to rent. And my guess is they would say, hey, by the way, you need to plant a tree, and then a tree gets planted. But I don't know entirely. I could ask a member of our neighborhood development staff to come in and talk about this item in a little more detail.
I won't be here, but... But maybe other people would be interested in that.
Yeah, you can watch online. Or come.
Yeah.
This is kind of really quick piggybacking off of what Zach said about native plants, but I don't know if there's also room for like a native plant ordinance. This is something like my partner has thought about. Like, she will be driving around to be like, you know, it'd be cool if there was like native plants, like just on the right of way, you know. So something to think about.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Kind of like in the Southwest, they have like ordinances about something similar. Like, you can't have lawns that you have to water, or you've got to do xeriscaping or whatever. Hmm. That's probably extreme to go all the way that far here where we, I don't know, but thinking about something like that could be interesting.
Very interesting. Why don't I talk to NDS a little about coming and talking to us about the ordinance sometime in the coming year? Because clearly there are things that I would like to learn about this as well.
I think even with like street trees, as far as traffic goes, it kind of naturally slows traffic down too. And so it serves as a, you know, public safety measure too. Just the maintenance is kind of can be tough.
It also has impacts on our heat islands, you know, which we've been working to map. One idea that we've been exploring recently is thinking about the future of the neighborhood energy blitz. As we reach more and more neighborhoods, and if there aren't variations on that that we could do, one of which would be to recruit volunteers to help fan out and tag newly planted street trees with instructions on how to maintain them. Because I will say, for the city's efforts, not just for street trees, which are trees planted directly along the street, but also in our natural areas, watering them so that they survive, it has become a key concern. You know, we were for a while losing a lot of the trees we planted. And now, of course, there are deer impacts that we have to be mindful of as well. So we've thought about putting out some immediately accessible information to help people maintain those trees that are planted, even though the city does come by and water them as well. But also just to do some data collection, both on these trees, and we've talked about potentially doing some data collection on Root for Trees to find out how many of the trees we've planted continue to exist, you know, and what other support we might offer. I could see us doing some work around that in the coming years. The next item is increased tree planting requirements in landscaping parking lots and upon renewal of rental permits. We have been in discussion with Neighborhood Development Services staff about this. This has been one that's been, we've had some difficulty getting some traction on it for a variety of reasons, not the least of which is in the current legislative environment, there's a real, I think strategically, most cities do not want to open their ordinances for fear that anything new we put on will be preempted. And that's particularly true for rental properties. I think it was before anyone's time on the commission here, but Stan Laverman, who conducts a lot of our efforts in this area and our enforcement of it, has shared guidance that if you cannot make a clear health and safety connection, like the radon requirement, chances are it's going to be vulnerable for being preempted. And so when that's the case, then what we start thinking about is instead of an ordinance, we start thinking about incentives. And in particular, our neighborhood development staff has just recently kicked off a parking study to reevaluate some of the parking requirements and parking needs in the city, partly with an aim to reduce some of those parking requirements at properties. And parallel to that, our office has begun looking at depaving programs in other cities that offer some incentives where if you take out some of your superfluous parking and replace it with natural areas planting, you can get an incentive to help offset the cost of doing that. It's very early days in those discussions, but depending on the results of the parking study, I could see that being something we would look more into in the coming years. The next item is develop review standards for new city facility construction and major rehabilitation that accounts for climate adaptation principles. It's funny, I actually just spoke to the annual Iowa meeting for the U.S. Green Building Council about resilient design features in recent construction, looking at our public works facility in particular and noting, like, that building was built with sustainability in mind, but some of those features really contribute to climate adaptation. Like the walls are almost 4 inches thick, and they're made from precast concrete and insulated units, so that there's a lot of thermal massing that would help in the event of a power disruption. The same goes for the polycarbonate windows that allow light, like, to come in daylight, so there's very low lighting needs in terms of artificial lighting in the building. That's also a climate adaptation measure. But in truth, how to better build buildings to withstand coming climate impacts is kind of new territory for the city. In the budget request for this year, I put in a request to hire a consultant to help us do a climate vulnerability and adaptation plan. As you'll recall, when we were discussing with the prioritization process, we identified that as a next step, that we would reprioritize the climate action plan as we have it and then try to come up with a more robust adaptation section. I think the study will help us better understand how to adapt, not just for floods, but for things like heat, for things like extreme weather. You know, and we see these questions coming up more and more. In the public works facility, there was a real discussion about how do we need to affix the solar array to the roof, given that derecho is a word we all know now, right? And we don't want those solar panels blowing off the building. How can we be implementing cool roofs on our buildings? Is it better to paint them white or put a living roof on, for example? Things like that. So I think this is an area where there's a lot of opportunity for us in the coming years, and it aligns with the city's strategic goals that were identified by council, where they asked us to do a refresh of the climate action plan and then do some more work around climate adaptation. So that's where I see this item going. The next item, flood mitigation and stormwater management programs, projects, and buyouts. You all are very familiar with this, thanks to recent discussions about what we should do for planning around the creeks. I will just say that where we're at with the city has continued to do floodplain buyouts where houses have become, when they've come on the market in the floodplain. I know we've discussed this in previous meetings, but we're at the point where those houses are of a value that's above what FEMA will buy out. Basically, any house above $350,000, that's the cap for FEMA buyouts. So we have to use local dollars to do those buyouts now. But the city remains committed to moving folks out of the floodplain along the river. And as you all discussed, we'll be paying attention to what happens with the creeks in future years. The next item, continued implementation of the natural area management plan. This is one that's really managed by our forestry staff, who provided the update for 2025. Basically, they have been doing a lot of continued build out of prairie areas and reforestation efforts. So you'll see the most recent is that there was a 40-acre parcel added to Hickory Hill Park. It doesn't feel added to it because it was part of ACT's campus that they allowed people to wander on. And then when ACT sold their campus, they essentially transferred ownership of that parcel over to the city because people had been using it to walk their dogs and felt very strongly about maintaining it as open access parkland. So we have more than 40 acres. We have 40 acres now that have been added to Hickory Hill, which is already our largest park. And our prairie area now exceeds 200 acres, which I think is incredible when you consider when I started with the city 5 years ago, we were putting in 80 more acres, you know, and we've gone from 80 to 200. And that 80, that first lift was hard, and it's become easier every year since then. So I think we're well on track to meet our natural areas goals. The other goal that we have is to try to plant 750 public trees each year. So that's distinct from the Root for Trees, which are trees planted on private areas. This is 750 trees added every year. We have met that goal every year up to 2025. We were on track to meet it in 2025, and then a federal grant we were using was frozen under the new administration. So that is where we fell short on that one. And that actually flows right into public tree planting. That actually covers a lot of it. we used another grant, the Trees Please grant, which, Wim, is that a Mid-American grant?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. Thank you, Mid-American. Our forestry staff usually pursues goals through the Iowa DNR or through MIDAM to help fund these activities. And you'll see that the Trees Please grant supported additional tree plantings at Ryerson's Woods. We've been putting in additional trees in Ryerson's Woods for about the last 3 years, and we've expanded prairie plantings out there. So it's a nice little area that is, I think, really getting the benefit from some of these efforts. And then the last item under adaptation is an equity review of neighborhood and population outreach, developing an outreach plan for populations highly impacted by climate change. This is one that we've been wrestling with over the years. And as you may recall, at the beginning of this year, we came to you with a changed approach to mapping it that was based on the utility discount program, like just mapping out participation in our programs against that. And that, I will say, has been a very helpful change for us. I foresee continuing to use that method for the foreseeable future, just because it really helped us identify areas where we weren't having quite the outreach we wanted and gave us something we could immediately act on. So a lot of different tries there. That one seems to be the one that's sticking. Are there any questions about the adaptation items? Yeah. Have you all been scoring as we go? Do you want a few minutes? Or shall we move on to sustainable lifestyle?
Actually, going back to ACP 1, the standards for city facility construction, I guess maybe I didn't totally follow through that one. What do you think would be, I mean, is there a whole lot more that can be expanded there, or do you feel like we've, you know, accomplished what we set out to there, or?
I think there's a lot more that we could do.
Okay.
I think we've not had a lot of guidelines in the past about climate adaptation specifically. We were pretty solid on energy efficiency and incorporating sustainable design in terms of creating designs that also are meant to withstand some impact of, you know, a climate change, whether it's maintaining temperature as things get hotter or withstanding storms. That, I think there's more work to be done.
Okay. Oh, this is the one where you're saying the vulnerability study
will help
inform.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay.
We've also, it's worth noting, we have not done a vulnerability study in over 10 years, and a lot has happened in those 10 years to suggest that it would be worth going back and looking at what the models say now. All right, sustainable lifestyle. SLE 1 is to host sustainability forum and events. This has taken a number of forms. You'll see there are a number of references here to about every other year we do something in collaboration with the Human Rights Office, the most recent being the inclusive transportation discussion that Angie Smith helped us coordinate or conduct the interview with the author. We have a number of events that AmeriCorps hosts as well. They have been doing Earth Expo for the last several years running, which is a sort of sustainability forum with area organizations working on this work. They do plan to do another one in 2026. And actually, they held one in 2025, so that's on me that I didn't include it in this update. I would say this is one that sometimes functions as a kind of generalized action item for us, where there are a number of things that we do that could fit under here, and we tend to report on just the like biggest or most notable. But we do consider it a core function of our office to conduct ongoing sustainability events throughout the year. The other thing that I think is of note here, and I think it gets referenced a couple different times in these updates, is just the pivot we've made in recent years to using Climate Fest as a kind of annual report to the community on our climate activities. We, much like other things in the plan, we've tried different approaches to Climate Fest, and that is the one that I think we've landed on as making the most sense and having gotten the most positive response from the community on. I have come to think of it as a really interesting effort in transparency, where once a year everybody in the community learns about how we're taking climate action, what their tax dollars are being spent on toward those ends. So I foresee that being an approach that we continue in the future as well. I shouldn't laugh. Climate action at work. This is an item that I will say, from a staff perspective, has ended up feeling a little like a dead end. As it was initially conceived in the Climate Action Plan, the idea is that we would develop a program that we would offer to businesses to help them with their sustainability, just to help them adopt sustainable practices. We took a couple different approaches to this, one of which was to start out just giving recognition to businesses that were already doing that work, because you always want to recognize people who, you know, are already there. Getting applications for those awards was like pulling teeth. It was really difficult. And we quickly ran through all the businesses that really were of note for major efforts. And of course, you don't want to neglect the folks who are doing what they can bit by bit. But we decided, in terms of staff effort versus outcome, that it made sense to retire the Climate Work Action at Work Awards. And we started looking at programs in other cities to offer help. But basically what we heard from the business community was that they were not necessarily interested in using us as consultants for sustainable actions. What this has, I think, morphed into is working with the organizations that come forward asking for TIF funding or climate action grants to identify further ways we could amplify the efforts they're already interested in. You know, saying you're interested in getting new windows. Have you also thought about a heat pump? You're interested in solar panels. Can we connect you with some energy efficiency resources? And I think that approach has worked well. You'll see I put a note in here that staff's recommendation, honestly, is to remove this item to avoid duplicate reporting. And that's just to say, like, our business efforts, I think, are really tied with incentives. And in many ways, that makes sense, right? Like, I think part of the resistance we ran into with businesses early on is, like, nobody wants to be told what to do if they don't have the resources to do it, even if it's, like, just a good idea and not something you're forcing them to do. And so I think reporting on these efforts under the incentives just is a more straightforward way of talking about what we're doing. That being said, if you want to keep it on there and say, go back, keep trying, you know, we can continue doing that as well. A very similar story for the local procurement campaign. This was originally oh gosh, and there are lots of X's on here. I'll explain the double X's. This was originally conceived as a program to try to get local businesses to buy supplies from other local businesses, right? To shorten the supply chain, in effect. And we looked at some programs in other communities, most notably the PEDL program that had been implemented a few years prior in eastern Iowa, up around Dubuque. And that program had also kind of run aground for similar, well, just businesses had difficulty meeting all their needs locally, right? The one area we really have had a lot of success in actually is in the food industry, where conceivably the supplies needed for restaurants can be met to some degree by local farms. And our biggest effort on this front has been with the Farm to Street fundraiser that we participate in each year and help sponsor with the downtown district. Most people know Farm to Street as a fundraiser that provides grants to the beneficiary organization to implement some local foods goals. What is less well known about that program is that area restaurants submit applications each year to participate. There are six different dishes. Each is provided by a different restaurant. So there are six different restaurants that we work with each year. And as part of the process, they start by proposing the foods they believe they could get locally for those dishes. And then we pair them with the county's local foods coordinator to identify additional farms that could help source material. And so the hope is, and in fact, what we've seen happen is we're expanding their supply chain locally, where they, for example, this year, you know, it was a revelation that there was a source for a local alternative to olive oil. And so it's actually really great, Zach. I saw the look of surprise.
It was a look of surprise. That's yeah. Cool. Great.
Yeah, no, I know.
It wasn't disbelief. It was just...
Yeah, that was not a criticism. That was like my enthusiasm for it.
Are you talking about the hickory oil?
Yeah, the hickory oil.
It's really good.
Isn't it? It's amazing. It's by the farm, I think, calls itself Fancy Twig. Is that right?
I think so.
Yeah, Fancy Twig, because it's based on yellow hickory trees, which have fancy twigs for hickory, as I understand it. But they've come up with a way of pressing hickory nuts for oil, and it actually is a great substitute.
It's how good it is.
Yeah. They sell at the farmer's market on Saturdays, and if you bring your own pint jar, you get a discount. Oh. So that's my advertisement for them, which is probably not entirely appropriate, but there it is. But basically what we do through that effort is we just help chefs who may not have a lot of time to be going out and identifying like what is new in the local food scene that they could be tapping into. And I actually think that that is the bigger and more sustainable long-term outcome of Farm to Street. These double X's, we sometimes put them in documents as a placeholder, as a reminder, like insert numbers here. And on this one, I can tell you that each year Farm to Street raises somewhere between $8,000 and $10,000 for the beneficiary. When I was preparing this report, I thought, you know, it would be really nice to record what those exact numbers are. And so I put the placeholders in and I wrote to the event coordinator at ICDD, who's the one who cuts the check at the end of the year, if she could send me confirmed numbers. I actually got an email from her this afternoon saying she'd have those numbers to me at the end of the day today. So the numbers aren't in your agenda packet, but they will be in these reports going forward. So you can see a basis of... For me, the value of putting the firm number in is you can see whether that number is rising or falling over time. Apologies that we didn't have it now. On the other end of the spectrum, the other recent development we've had in terms of local procurement is with the expansion of the ability to capture methane and actually prior to that do some biodigestion at our wastewater treatment plant. We have begun conversations with local businesses that could provide feedstock for that, which is a way of saying we could, right now, for example, like local breweries, have their used mash at the end, and they're not sending it to the landfill, which is great, but they're shipping it off to other places to be reused. Some of them send them to farms to be eaten by cattle. Some of them send them to other biodigesters. Because we will now have this ability, we have begun reaching out to say, hey, would you like to keep that in Iowa City and send it to us? So there's, I feel like we're shortening the supply chain on the intake area and on the outtake in one very specific area. But I think that's been the big lesson we've learned from this section, is that local foods is really where we have the most ability to do that work. So I would anticipate that going forward, our local procurement efforts would continue to be very local foods focused. Unless, of course, you would like us to, you know, keep trying to explore other areas, which we are happy to do. The next item is expand community climate action grants. This has taken a couple different forms. A few years ago, we increased the amount that we were giving out so that we could, instead of, we had been offering about $50,000 in climate action grants. Now we offer somewhere around $60,000 each year. But we also have begun doing carve-outs. Basically, where we thought of expanding the climate action grants as creating more focused grants. So the first example, that would be the reusable food containers grant that we saw. We saw a lot of applications coming in for those sorts of things. And so we said, could we create a carve out that's a non-competitive grant? And that could be offered year round, since this is something that seems to come up over and over. And we don't want to tell businesses that are interested in it, oh, gee, this is a great idea. Can you wait 12 months to apply and then, you know, 16 months to implement? We had looked at doing something similar for solar arrays for nonprofits. I think this may be before any of your time on the commission, but we had a year where, or two, where we saw a lot of applications coming through for solar arrays for nonprofits, and we thought, gosh, should this be its own climate grant as well? We reached out to local nonprofits to ask about it, and what we found out is that we basically helped all the ones that owned their own buildings, and the ones that didn't have the ability to add solar to their roof. And so we decided against creating a carve-out grant there. This coming year, we have a really interesting opportunity that has come up with the Iowa Waste Reduction folks, who've gotten a grant to do small business energy audits. Our energy audits only focus on residential properties. They have the ability now to go into small businesses and do an audit and make some recommendations. And what we're hoping to do is make a little carve out so that as we help them recruit businesses to participate in it, we can say, and here's some money to implement one of their recommendations or two of their recommendations, so that there's some follow through on it. I think this approach to climate action grants has worked fairly well for us, but I do think this is one that we would benefit from a little guidance from the commission on. At the moment, I think creating these kind of carve-outs from the existing funds we have is probably our best strategy for this year and next year, you know, given that we've got some budget constraints. But it could be in the future we have the opportunity to offer more money through the Climate Action Grant Program. So I imagine that's something that wouldn't necessarily be decided today, but that we could be coming to you with questions about in the future. SLI 1 or 2 is incentives for the public to create and maintain local food production and community gardens. This is one. Parks and Rec usually, they have the direct management of our community garden plants, and they have their own processes for determining when it's the time is right or when they've got enough requests to open up some more plots. I think in the recent years, they've been concentrated more just on managing the current plots better and improving the infrastructure at them. You might recall a few years ago, for example, at Chaddock Green, they added water on site and they put in some ADA accessible plots and some sidewalks to enable folks to better get to their plots. I think that's how they've been increasing access, just making sure that the existing plots, first and foremost, are accessible to everyone. We also have had some efforts, most notably increasing our allowance for the number of chickens for folks who have chicken permits. It's a story for another day, but like there are six animals explicitly mentioned in our ordinances. I did a deep dive several years ago to try to figure out what was and wasn't allowable for beekeeping in the city. And bees are allowed, but rhea are not, which is like my favorite little mystery in our ordinances. Like, why did we prohibit a big flightless bird? What precipitated that? I think a lot of our local food production and community gardens, I think this is something that probably is a steady as she goes item from our perspective in that Parks and Rec maintains it. But we do, the ways our office directly interacts with it is largely through climate action grants. And you'll see that this last year, for example, Global Food Project received a climate action grant to purchase farm tools and equipment to support their local foods efforts out at the farm. And Dream City also got a climate action grant to help support the energy efficient equipment they put in their incubator kitchens. So there's some production for local foods support there as well. And I think probably our ability to support this work really flows from the climate action grants and the applications we receive there. The next item is develop a green procurement policy. We actually have worked with our procurement staff on this. They have set up several things recently or in recent years to help support sustainable procurement. One is they have worked with our vendors, I think most notably the this always feels like a weird one to reference under sustainability, but the city does have a business Amazon account, and our procurement staff worked with Amazon to make sure that green options floated to the top of the search results. It's not nothing. probably the bigger thing we did was actually work with our procurement staff last year to host a statewide public procurement meeting to look at what was possible for a sustainable procurement. And we invited a speaker from Ann Arbor to zoom into that and talk about work that has gone on in peer cities. I don't know that there were a lot of things that our city necessarily implemented in response, but we did collaborate with a number of other cities to kind of get everybody on the same page on that front. That's another one, I think, where the needle's a little harder to move, but we continue to work on it. I don't know that we have any clear ideas of, you know, what more to do other than to keep looking at sustainable procurement practices of other cities and when things seem to fit, you know, adopting them for Iowa City. But this is one, admittedly, we've not done as much with. So if it's a high priority for you, we can make it a high priority for us. The next item is develop a city sustainable operations guide and make available to the public and organizations throughout Iowa City. Similar to what we were talking about with climate action at work, where businesses don't necessarily want to be told what to do, they also, I think if our sense has been in our conversations with them, and we've had a couple focus groups, that if we offered a guide, it would be like, that's nice, but what do you really know about the ins and outs of operating my business? That, you know, the advice we could give is so high level as to not be terribly engaging, let's say. But here, too, one area that we've had some success in is developing guidance for the city on aligning our food procurement practices with our climate action goals. So last year, our staff actually convened the staff ambassadors from different departments to talk about how was food being purchased and used at events, what were the kinds of tools they would need to feel confident in, say, offering more plant-rich options or to weigh the different impacts of different things that they're purchasing, right? Is chicken a lower carbon option than pork, for example, you know? And actually, I will say one of the things I really love about that process is that we identified through it that aligning goals with some of our, or aligning our practices with some of our climate action goals, like really promoting plant-rich diets, also met some of our goals to just be welcoming as a community, that the easiest way to make sure you're meeting the needs of attendees who might be keeping halal or kosher is to offer a plant-rich menu. And so that's actually how the document ended up being called Everyone at the Table. We do have a goal with Kendall on board to re-engage with that. We kind of rolled it out and said, here's the guidance, but we don't have a clear sense of what the uptake has been in different departments. So we're hoping that both with reinitiating our staff ambassador program and getting Kendall on board, we can better engage with departments and provide further support for the uptake of that project.
Sarah, is that available to be shared by chance?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I would love to see it.
Yeah.
It was actually a question I was asked about a month ago.
Oh, were you?
Just for the county. Yeah. So that'd be great.
We had involved Ilsa DeWald in some of the, who's the local foods coordinator, in some of the initial conversations. And actually, as I was typing up this, I was like, did we ever send a copy to Ilsa when we were done? So this just confirms we need to.
Yeah, that's great.
But yeah, no, we'd be happy to share it. And then have we talked about community garden expansion twice? Yeah, a little bit. SLI-1, which is incentives for the public to create and maintain local food production, kind of overlaps with our community garden and expansion. This one goes back to, this is why I confuse the two. So the incentives are about the grants we offer under climate action, grants to private entities to develop things like an education garden at Horace Mann, right? This item has to do with the ones that are maintained by the city. So my apologies for confusing the two. And then I actually think I gave away my back page on this. So here you get to see me tap dance a little. What's the next action item?
Develop a climate action strategic communications plan.
All right, develop the strategic communications plan. I think we can call that one completed. As you can recall, we hired, well, I think it was before your time on the commission. We worked with a marketing campaign to develop a social marketing program. That's how we came to get Goldie to unify our climate action efforts. Goldie's been a really powerful tool that we continue to use, I think, to good effect. Our intention in years forward is just to continue implementing the principles in that plan. So I think similar to action items from other areas where we've completed it, and for example, the fleet transition plan or the EV transition plan, where we, instead of saying, you know, conduct this, we say implement recommendations, we would probably change the wording on this to say continue implementation of the plan. Is that the last one?
Yep.
All right.
Yep. All right. Well, do you have anything else?
No, I think if you've got your score sheets completed, if you just want to leave them on your where you're sitting, we'll come around and pick them up, and I'll compile them and bring them to the January meeting. See, Michelle, Jamie, and Angie, you're going to have to come back to see what rose to the top.
I've got a report in my office. I'll make sure I hear from Cole about how things are going. So, all right. Well, great. Well, we don't have any members of the public here, so we'll skip that public comment. So the next meeting will be Monday, January 5th, 4 to 5:30 in the city manager's conference room right next door.
Yeah. And we will have staff in the lobby to help conduct you there. Since we won't be cutting through this room, we'll be going up through revenue to get there.
And then action items for commission and staff.
We didn't discuss this, but the one remaining section that we haven't gone through a report on is waste. And that is because almost like all of those actions are handled outside of the Climate Action Division. So I've asked our resource management staff to help prepare the report on that. And we'll be sharing that at hopefully at our January meeting so you can see the progress being made. We've also asked them to identify the you may recall when Jane presented at the beginning of the year, she talked about how they develop 7 objectives and targets each year for their own operations. Rather than have us come up with a separate target, we've asked them to just identify the one that is most aligned with the Climate Action Plan, and we'll adopt that as the metric for that section as well.
All right. Well, it sounds like we are adjourning a little early, so it's motion to adjourn.
Silman motions to adjourn.
Great. Bork seconds.
All right, all in favor.
Aye. Aye.